From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in particular, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games.
In this episode, we talk with Laura Onderwater, concept artist, to discuss art workflows. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
It's the summer of returning guests.
Yeah.
I guess we've decided.
Yeah.
We've booked a couple favorites to come back on the program. And Laura, you're one of them. Welcome back to the clubhouse.
Oh, glad to be back. I'm glad. I'm a favorite. Oh, that's so lovely to hear.
We had you on previously to discuss environmental storytelling, which you just reminded me of before we started recording. Steven, you described that as a good one.
Oh yeah, it was
a banger.
Great. I remember thinking about that for a long time afterwards. So listeners, if you haven't listened to that one, maybe go back into the archives and check it out. But before, listen to this one first, because we're already talking.
We'll put the link in the show notes.
Yes,
it's available for you later. It's not like a part. You're not gonna miss anything.
Right.
In this one,
yeah.
You're not caught up on part one or anything.
Yeah. That's true. That's true.
But for listeners,
no, they definitely need to go back and hear it all. They definitely need to go back and hear everything before now.
Yeah.
You can't miss an episode.
Yeah, pause. We'll wait for you. Well, for those of you, just returning, you can just, sit tight for a second, because the folks who didn't jump and listen to that one or haven't, this is very tortured. but Laura, why don't you describe a little bit about your background and the work that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, I am a concept artist. I've been working in video games for, I want to say 6 to 7 years. I haven't counted. I don't want to feel that old yet. But I've worked mainly doing a lot of freelance work. I've done production studios. I worked recently with a VR company for about 2 years. That's basically it. I have done a lot of work with environment concept art, prop concept art, but I've gone the whole gambit, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And what I really liked about the previous episode you were on is when we talk about like workflows and disciplines in games, I think concept art is something for indie developers in particular gets kind of like either forgotten about, or it's an unknown area.
Yeah,
I think for a lot of people, particularly in the indie space, and they don't either realize like the value of it or what makes it different from other types of art production.
Right.
And so that was really fun to learn about then. But I think we're going to dig into that sort of again now and talk a little bit more on the technical side about like tools and workflows and systems and stuff like that. And I'm pretty excited to sort of dig back into this sort of topic. And hopefully this will stick with you again, Steven, for a long, long time. But I guess the first thing we should sort of talk about is just like, what is the ultimate deliverables that you make? What do you produce for as a concept artist for a studio or a client or for your own projects?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I think the best way to answer that is by saying, a lot of people think of concept art, you're going to be making, pretty pictures. You're going to be creating these, incredible designs, these beautiful characters. And that is part of it. But that's only a very small fraction of it. A lot of times what I'm delivering isn't even finished complete pieces. They aren't things that I would put on my art station. They are answering questions of like, what is this character? What could they look like? Here's 50 designs. And this is what they don't look like because the client doesn't like them, but they didn't know that until I showed them.
Right.
Right, yeah.
So you're narrowing down ideas. It is also a lot of getting overall, I hate to say this because it sounds really plithy, but vibes. So sort of, you're designing a game, even if it's indie or higher in like AAA or triple I or whatever, you design this environment and you have to figure out, okay, well, here's what the director has said. They want a moody vibe. Well, that could be 100 things. So it's up to me to then take, all right, well, this is a nighttime scene. Does it have to be really spooky? Is it actually more melancholy? And from there, it turns into, well, here's everything designed around the first few sketches. Like I said, nothing I create has, or not everything I create, rather, is a complete beautiful piece that would be in an art book. Mm-hmm. But I'm answering questions for everybody on the team.
Yeah. Yeah. So does the depth of those questions vary? I'm guessing perhaps sometimes it's like, hey, we need something that's yada yada. Or sometimes it's like, hey, here's this huge document of all the requirements. Like, Does the depth of what of the requests do they vary wildly, or are there certain categories of questions that tend to come up over and over again?
I'd say it is definitely varied in a ways. I haven't seen in myself the patterns of the categories, but I'm sure they exist. Mm-hmm. The best way I can put it is a lot of times there are, I would say, limitations that are given in the design. So people definitely know what they don't like, and that is usually the limitation of, like, they don't want the character to have, you know, 15 layers of cloth because that's harder to animate, or they don't want something to happen with the hair because they want to have interchangeable hats, so you have to try and bring that in. But then other times, I've had a couple of clients basically say, we're giving, you know, we don't know what the world looks like. Just give us what you think this could be. Here's the 2-sentence synopsis of the game. And I have to try and take that and turn it into, well, here's a docket of 5 options. Are any of these hitting? Yes, no, let's move on from here. Mm-hmm. It's a very iterative process, I think, of, yeah, when it comes to that side. And even the very specific, you know, very rigid way is iterative in that sense. But there is a whole, just like, there is no one thing I would say is like, this is exactly it. It could be 100 questions. It could be 100 limitations. It could be nothing.
Yeah.
So
yeah. It's interesting you talk about sometimes that will include design restrictions or technical considerations early on, and other times it won't. Does the level of do those constraints depend on the client, or is it really depending on the type of client? So basically what I mean is, are you more likely to get the "we don't know what we want" from a certain type of client, either a studio or a you serving as a contractor, or something where it's more like you're looking for 5 designs rather than 1. And then when it's more specific, is it more a bigger studio or a smaller studio might have those? Basically, what do those types of, does that, the variability, does that come with the type of client you have, or is it really just each project is different?
You know, the easy answer to say is each project is different, but I've found actually that the amount of people who know what they want and know their limitations are usually smaller indie companies or independent creators who have done this before, who either are very well versed in either programming or design. They've done game jams. They know what they can do. They know what's possible. And they know that, oh, well, I can't program this in yet. It'd be nice to have, but I know that I don't have cloth physics. Mm-hmm. So even if this looks cool, we can't do that. So I'll make sure that it doesn't even come up.
Right.
Because sometimes when you see a beautiful designer, like a designer falls in love with a concept,
right,
they can focus on it and it becomes a problem later on.
Yeah.
So very, very well experienced designers will have I found that they almost have limits for themselves of, we're not even going to entertain this idea. So let's not bring it up. And like I said, I found that more on indie side because they have so much more control. Mm-hmm. In studios, anybody can be at the top just giving an order down, and that changes what the rest of the team does.
Right.
And that could be swayed by so many things. So it's almost a little bit harder to have those limitations right away unless you have a very, very good and very strict management system,
yeah,
I find.
Okay.
It also sounds to me a little bit like when there's a bigger company involved, they can kind of pay for possibilities.
Yeah. Exactly, yes.
Right? Like, they can let you give you 5 or 6 ideas, and then they can deal with the fallout. Whereas an indie studio is like, okay, we only can afford this much concept art, and we already know what our constraints are elsewhere. That's interesting, that it's like, it's 2 dimensions. Mm-hmm. It's the scale of the client, but also the experience of the client can give you that. Because I can imagine you can get a smaller client who doesn't know what they want, and that can be very painful as time goes on.
It can be. And I no fault to anybody who's starting out, because that's how you learn, as you go through, you trial and error. But you can almost tell sometimes that a young designer has starry eyes of, like, they want everything in their game. And if they get concept art or they find concept art, they want, you know, what the ideal is. And it can be hard to almost say, like, are you certain that this is what you want? Because, you know, it is their design. It is what they want to have. But, you know, I can't be there to say, maybe bring down your expectations.
Right. So, and that's not your job either, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's fascinating. It's interesting that you bring up that idea of, like, people getting stuck in a rut sort of with respect to, like, an important idea that they've seen in the concept art or something like that, because I think that I would imagine actually that would, like, gum up the process a little bit. Like, if there were five concepts and one just looks really cool and you iterate off of that one concept, but something's not working right and it's not quite working, meshing with everything else in the game, in some way, I'm not an artist, but I can imagine that would make it difficult to branch out from that perspective.
Yeah. At that point, it quickly could end up being a darling that you need to kill.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And you have to recognize that. You want to recognize that early. And imagine concept artists are probably better at that, maybe. Would you say that you were better at that than others?
You learn to be better at that. Okay. Definitely 100% kill your darlings. Like, as Drawfee says, kill your art, delete your art. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I fall in love with some ideas, but I've had to just let it go. Like, it would be a nice to have. Because, well, I'll be quite honest, our concept art, we're not exactly the top of the totem pole here. Like, we are just creating art for everyone else to use. And so if something isn't working, even if I love it, I just gotta let it go. Mm-hmm. And it kind of the same way you said, like, it can gum up things if you focus too much on it.
Yeah.
It also means that for us as concept artists and even just artists in general, being able to iterate off that and say, like, okay, so this isn't quite working, but here's a couple other options of, like, the same vein. Can we iterate off that, change it? Let's see if we can't make things work a little better. Mm-hmm. And usually clients in a lot of studios are a lot more open to that because, you know, it's something that people love and the team loves, and you can almost sort of massage it to make it fit the design brief better.
Right. It sounds like
it takes time.
It sounds very much that, like, unlike a lot of artists that I work with who make assets and such or do final designs, that your definition of done is not the piece of art is finished. It is all the questions have been answered. And whether you end up with, like, if that ends up being a piece of art that is ostensibly done or could be shown or just a bunch of mess still, then, like, that's kind of equal in terms of your job is finished here.
100%. Because, like I said, the concept artist is not the be-all, end-all. Like, it is done, it is in the game. My art is going to get touched by the 3D artists, the people who are doing the texturing, modelers, animators, people who are integrating it, doing the lighting. I'm basically, like you said, like, my done has to be enough for the next person to be able to use and the next person to be able to then go off of that. And as long as whatever I make is workable and nobody has any major questions or is that somebody can even see and say, oh, I get what you're doing, I'm done. I've got 17, 100, 180 more concepts to finish.
Yeah, it sounds very, very akin to kind of what I have to do as a designer, you know, because I live in terms of, like, storyboards, documentation, and just get it solid enough that we can then go forward without being prescriptive and without backing yourself into a corner in terms of problems that will eventually come up.
Right.
It's shockingly 100%. Similar how much our workflows are kind of matching.
It is. It's actually on one of the last games I worked on. I was actually in the meetings with the design team mm-hmm. to try and figure out, like, this is how the gameplay workflow is. All right, I'm going to now take this and sort of see the beats in the story and the beats in the gameplay. How can I make them marry together? And you're right. Like, it absolutely is the same sort of, we need just to get this to a point that we can move on. And it is malleable enough that it can change later if it doesn't work, but we still have our workflow going. Mm-hmm. Like, we have a plan.
Yeah, there's, like, a sort of a metaphor people use with design documents, and it would apply to concept art as well, which is, like, there's sort of the blueprints for a project, but that's an imperfect metaphor because it's not really how games are made.
No, right? I mean, the thing about design documentation is it is obsolete as soon as it starts being produced off of.
Yeah.
Because it has to be kind of the origin point, the thing it has to be left behind.
Right, right. And with a piece of concept art, you have a character with a really cool rectangular belt buckle, and then at some point, the art director is like, we're going to make that a circle.
Uh-huh.
You don't have to go back and change that in the concept art necessarily.
No.
But then there are some things where you're like, oh, we want a different color palette. You might want to go back and see how that feels before committing a lot of art resources to it, I suspect. So why don't we start with that those types of decision making? So independent of the actual like production art workflow, let's talk about the communication workflow.
Sure.
How do you receive those requests? Or those questions? In what form? And how do you go back and forth? How do you track those sorts of things? Let's start with before you actually put, pen to screen.
All right. Well, I've been lucky enough to have a lot of very good production managers and designers that I've worked with, as well as like, even while I'm doing freelance stuff, I've learned to try and lead people down a path of here's what I need from you. And so that actually is basically I have a set of questions of like, what is this going to be used for? Do you have any plans for this to be changed later on? Is this going to be something that needs to be, multiple variations? So like a color change or a palette swap of a character. And then figuring out the end result and just getting a list is kind of the start of it of, all right, so this is what has to be done. And this is what has to happen to this element or this concept art. And then from there, it's any references. Like if God tier, if you have anybody who gives you reference images to what you need. God, oh, my Lord. Just because people can say, oh, I just want, a rocky environment. I want a desert. Well, a desert's 100 things.
That's a lot of deserts.
Do you want more? You want the Sahara? Do you want like the Grand Canyon? Do you want, fantasy? So if you have if somebody has something in mind that they already want, giving that information to the concept artist already solves 90% of my problems and answers a lot of my questions already, because I've been given the background you need. I've been given the reasoning behind it. And I've also just been able to pull some information out of you, hopefully, even just by looking at the references you make of like, all right, so it's a desert, but I need to know that there's this sort of rocky formation, and then there's crystals or something, but I know you want them to be this. And from there, after that initial sort of start of it, it turns into a conversation of, is this correct? What other questions do you have? Like for a designer or someone who's hiring me, it would be basically like, what else do you need this to happen, and how else do you need this to be in terms of, is the character supposed to be able to walk around this whole place? Is this just meant to be a reference photo for your designers to say, like, here is the general mood? Mm. So that's sort of the start of it. I think that answers that question. Yeah. I went on a bit of a tangent there.
Well, it sounds like, and definitely like what you spoke to earlier about how like each project is different and like the context is different, what form that early request takes, but it just comes to you in some written form and hopefully some reference images. And who that comes from is probably different too, right? Sometimes would that come from a creative director or from a more specialized art director? Does it include things like color palettes, brand guides, stuff like that? How common is that versus just here's a paragraph of what we want?
I would say it's much more common to get things like brand guides, color palettes, things like that are much more written out from larger companies or somebody who has a very specific idea of what they want. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes I've done logo design where a indie developer has given me, the brief as well as the, where it's going to be used, what it's going to be used for. And that's very much the brand design and the brand document. Versus sometimes it'll be just a conversation and I'll have to write out my notes and then post it to a creative director or something, or even like the person who's hired me to sort of get a paper trail of this is what you said and this is how it is. Because it is a bit of a mix of sometimes it's just a meeting. Sometimes it's a Slack message. Sometimes it's a Gantt chart and you have the actual Jira task. Sometimes it's I message, like it's basically in the middle of a conversation about another design problem of like, oh, we need concept for this. Laura, could you knock this up? Like, so unfortunately, it really is like there is no set of this is exactly how it should be. Mm-hmm. The kind of the ideal is to have a conversation about it and then a Jira task or some kind of written note with your documentation. But, you know, that doesn't always happen. Yeah. Like I said, as you're drawing things up, as you have to start pumping out ideas, things can get lost and things can just sort of happen in the moment, which is why anybody who's doing this needs to have a paper trail.
Right.
Just get confirmation. Send that message back to your director. Send that message back to your client. Like, you said this on this meeting. Do I have this correct? Mm-hmm. That saves you so much headache.
Sure. Yeah.
It's fascinating how it seems like the most important thing really is the necessity to be flexible with how you're creating this concept art. Because, yeah, the guidance you get and what you want to do can come in so many different forms that you can't really just like, you can't really just rely on one specific tool to get it all done. At least to communicate that or understand what it is that you're looking from the client.
Exactly. Yeah. It has to be flexible because you're right. It is, there are so many people who have different ideas for what they want, and you have to kind of work with them because going against or even like fighting against someone's idea or fighting against someone's way of doing it, you're not going to get any information and you're not really going to have a great relationship with your boss or your clients if you do that. So to borrow a great phrase, is like, they're the head, you're the neck. You need to kind of move them the way you want them to and do it very kindly.
Okay, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
one thing I caught in that last bit of response is talking about like, in a meeting, someone will say, oh, hey, we need this, Laura, can you do it? And that's interesting because that you don't, you might at a beginning of a project or at stage of the project, you have, this is what we need, this is what we need, these are the five things we need. But it sounds like that too is flexible. And so you kind of need to be in those meetings, you need, at least certainly in a studio environment, you need to be available. So how much of your time is kind of waiting for those requests? Mm.
More than I'd like, I would say, but definitely, I would say waiting for those requests, I would say was probably like 10% of a day. Okay. Was just sort of kind of, I was not part of any major, you know, life-changing decisions with the game, but when we were talking about specifically art and these things were happening, and then designers would come in and say, oh, we've added this mechanic, and then it would turn to the discussion of, well, this enemy now has to do X, Y, Z. Laura, we need you to figure this out. I would say like a good, 10% of a day. So I wouldn't even remember. I don't ask you to do math. I'm in art for a reason. But it is like you would sort of just kind of get these out of a meeting or even just a ping on Slack saying, hey, we need a concept for this. And then you'd have to figure out, all right, well, what's my triage? Is this more important than what I'm working on now?
Right.
And sometimes the answer is yes, because the designers need something immediately because they need to put it in and test it. And mm-hmm. So what is this going to look like? So the modelers can do a rough sketch or a rough mock-up to put in the game to test out.
Yeah. So how does that differ then for a project where you're serving more as a contractor, where you are not at the office or in the Slack channels necessarily, full-time? When the brief is, we need this much concept art, and we'll come back to you with these steps or whatever that contract looks like. Are you able to find that level of flexibility? Are you able to field those kinds of requests, or does that go over scope? Does that become difficult when it's more like gig work, where you're like, well, this isn't what you paid for? Like, how does that change based on the context of the project you're working on?
I think it's actually, as you said, a little bit more sticking to the contract you wrote. Mm-hmm. So it is a lot less of fielding those requests, unless this is a project that I was really involved in. Even as a contractor, I was more willing to take on those fast requests. But it also kind of goes against right now in some of my contracts, and a lot of people I know who have the contracts of, you paid for this amount of work, you're paying for me to do this many hours, let's say. It's kind of within those boundaries of, do I have the time? Do you have the budget to do this? And sometimes the answer is yes, and I can, mock something up. Or sometimes the answer is no, and then it's like, well, do you want to add on hours, or do you want to scrap it? Or do you even need me to do this? Mm-hmm. So when it comes to freelancing and getting those sort of contract gig work, it's almost like the person who hires me has to be a little bit more on top of it and a little bit more secure in what they know that they need. And if something pops up, then it becomes a different conversation.
Yeah.
So yeah. Definitely in the studio, it's a lot more on the fly and being way more flexible.
Right. Because you're in on gig call, work, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. I am basically the world's worst surgeon.
Yeah.
When it comes to that.
Well, it highlights what you said earlier about, in a different context, about the paper trail. Right.
That
matters in all areas, I suspect.
Oh, yes. Because, you know, you'll get your art lead giving you like, hey, this needs to be done first. It's like, okay. So if somebody comes at me, you know, the 3D artist asks me like, hey, are you done this? Like, no, I'm not. And you can take it up with this guy. So shift the blame.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. And yeah, I definitely think that like it helps to have that paper trail. I was wondering how you like keep track of all the different art you're making, but like if you're you got a paper trail going, then like you know what you are supposed to be doing, and you have the art to say what you've done.
I get no, but the thing is like if you archive, how do you archive and name things so that way you can go back to previous ideas or you can find previous iterations?
Yeah,
because I have seen how some people label their files, and it's bad.
Oh, yep. Final for real.
And
this time.
Drives me nuts.
2024.
Yeah. Yep.
Let's talk technical. Like, how do people see? Do you just send out JPEGs? Like, how do people see and catalog and track?
Yeah.
Both pieces of art and collections of art and versions of art. What are the tools?
Well, especially considering like. Because you are doing an iterative process and you may iterate in a direction and then find out you need to backtrack. But I imagine because part of what you said was collecting things that don't work and making sure that those are known as well, that you have to make sure that that is also recorded and known. So that way, if you disappear, they know like, oh, we're supposed to do this version, not this version, but we have this version to know why we hate this version.
Yep. So you'll be happy to know my naming conventions are actually very good.
That's
I've had to make them that way.
Okay.
I've had to do it that way because I have lost work by accidentally putting the wrong name or the wrong file number.
Oh.
Everyone learns it once.
So only once. And that was the only time. And I learned from my mistakes. So
I think every game developer should have to do museum cataloging and past perfect,
right.
Perfect, so they know how to name files properly.
Yeah.
It's amazing because someone in my family is an archivist, so she's instilled in me how to do naming convention, how to do filing. So it's like, all right, I know how to do it now. But
Lydia is so you're right. Excited.
I learned I like design by going into museums and finding I liked exhibit design. So I did collections care. That's how I learned how to name things properly. So this makes me so happy. And it's a good skill.
Right. Mm-hmm. I passed the Lydia check. Perfect. No, to answer your question, I always say the best way to do it, this is one thing I learned from my art lead in my last project, was the name of it, basically the name of whatever you're working on. So environment _, you know, whatever it is. So like desert1_, the state it's in, and then _ V number. This works for me. So that way it's like, let's say desert sketch version 1, version 2. That way it's a numerical way of just kind of going through. And it's not perfect, obviously. Trying to sort of backtrack can be a bit difficult, but at least you now have like, all right, I have version 5, but I don't have version 6 or 7, but we have version 8. So something happened in between here. At least there's a way to sort of figure that out. Mm-hmm. It also is a little easier for people to look up because if you, like I said, if you have a naming convention, even if it's different, you at least figure it out. Mm-hmm. But it is a little harder because by the end, you do have a shit ton of work that you've made. And some of it is like just not necessary, or it's all these sketch work that no one's ever going to see again, but you needed to make it.
Yeah.
So you quickly come up with archives of like, all right, well, here's the work in progress work. Here's the finalized. Here's the approved. And I actually make notes on a lot of my documents as, you know, as they're being approved or disliked or being commented on or critiqued. My Photoshop documents always have a layer that just says notes and the day. Mm. And it'll say who is in it and who's in the meeting. So I can at least have that as a something to look back on. It's not perfect. Nothing is ever going to be perfect when it comes to this. But it's the best way I found to work as a way of like a living document. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, all right, here's where we have this.
That's so cool to have people's names on the document. Because like, if you have questions about a thing and you don't remember who brought this thing up, you can ask somebody who's at the meeting if they remember who brought it up.
That's also really nice. I mean, if you're in a position where you do have to cover your butt, you can say like, this decision was made with these people in the room.
Right.
Yes.
And then you can kind of move forward that conversation.
Yeah.
It's a lot more helpful than, for example, trying to find the right Google Meet, because especially if some people said yes and then they don't actually attend, yes. For example.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. It's also, this is something that I've sort of done recently in the past, whereas every person has a color assigned to them in this, like a Photoshop document. Mm-hmm. So if someone has like, oh, I want to change the pauldron in bright green, I'll have it circled with that note. So I can, not only just the name, but I can tell like who gave me what note.
Sure.
Yeah. And if I was told like, hey, you know, disregard anything that this person said, which hasn't happened. I've never had somebody completely go over someone's head, but I'm planning for the inevitabilities.
Right, right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it gives you a lot of context too, because some people communicate differently, right?
Right.
Yeah. When someone says, I want this to look this way, you know that when that person says it, they're being very literal. When another person says it, they're being more like directional. And so just remembering not just the note, but the context of the note. And I like that you have a very art-focused way to track that sort of thing, which is, that's cool. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. It's like sometimes I just get the note, like, I want that to be more swooshy. It's like, all right, you mean you want it to have like this more of a flow without taking up too many polygons. Got it.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah. I find that the artistic way, if I try and write it down in a document, my brain won't remember it. So if I actually write it out with my own hand, it makes more sense to me.
Well, I really like that also. It's so close to the thing that's being commented on, because then you can see, one, the reoccurring words that keep coming. And then you can get you have a visual timeline of swooshy, swooshy, swooshy. Okay, we've had too much swoosh. Bring it back. You can go back to the previous not enough swoosh and compare the two. Or you can start trying to get a sense, you almost start to have an ophthalmologist test where it's like, is this swooshy enough, or you want this type, or you want this type?
I'm enjoying the swooshy.
The swooshy, yeah. That's a word.
It is now.
I really like that, because then it also then means that your further conversations are going to be easier, because you have a structure for, and you have a record and timeline for the iteration itself.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. It really is sort of a backtrack of like, all right, I can tell now archivally how this went and where a sticking point was. Mm-hmm. And so now I know how to communicate with you to get the answer that we both want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It thinking a lot about the getting the digesting the information that you need, getting it close to the work that you're doing, and literally like putting it in the project files. I'm thinking a lot about how that's the kind of problem that a lot of like pieces of software and tooling are trying to solve, that you've sort of solved in a more organic way. But there are things like Photoshop has like an online thing where you can Creative Cloud has a thing where you can do like producer's notes and stuff like that. It's like fine. But there are many tools like that are designed to solve problems like this and work with workflows. Do you use anything like that? Or is it much more, here's image files in a folder somewhere, and here's the naming convention that gives us versioning, maybe more natural, more organic? Or are there more like specific tools, maybe even in Jira, you know, God forbid, your systems interface with everybody else who needs to see it?
I would say myself, I use a lot more of the organic side. Mm-hmm. I haven't had need. It really is how I work, is I don't like using like the cloud system, because I tend to lose information or don't recall it. But on that side, working with studios, working with companies, or even like as a contractor, you have to use what they are also using, just because it's their ballgame, it's their work. So I haven't had to do too much on, you know, the online cloud system, beyond Jira. Jira has been the one that has been a constant. Mm-hmm. But I've actually found it pretty okay because it's a visual system for me and somebody can look at it, approve it, and then put it over to another position. And I have a backup log of everything I need. And I also can have sort of, it solves one problem of having the images up and having a record of here is every piece that was approved and here's some pieces that were declined, but here is now where we're at this stage.
I imagine also it's kind of easier as well that you could, for the people who are working off of it, you can add the specific images to their ticket so you know exactly which concept they are basing their own assumptions off of. As opposed to
yes.
giving them the whole folder and hoping and hoping that they pick the right one or wondering which one they're using.
That's actually 100% why, is because I can just put up, here is the approved image, here is a link or even like the documents that had it, but don't look at those unless you have questions and ask me first. Here's the final.
Yeah.
You can take it. But this only works as long as you keep it updated. And that is something... every project manager I've ever worked with has been a gem and has helped me figure it out and get it to going. So
yeah,
definitely that's the one thing, is no matter what system you use, you have to keep it updated because it's very easy to create things, get into a conversation with a lead or someone you're working with and something's been approved, but now you have like all this backlog of images and which one was which. So you just need to have some kind of living system that will keep it going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if something was approved and no one was around to witness it, was it really approved?
Nope. Yeah. That's an easy question to answer.
Well, it also sounds like it's not probably that effect or that smart to get really invested as a competence artist in a distribution and approval workflow of your own, because you're just going to have to use whatever the client or studio or project requires. And so it seems like you just need to be as flexible and as organic as possible, because and because you're not really ever going to be able to make the choices on how those things work.
Unless you're very high up, you've been very integrated with the process at the beginning, you know, you will have some studios that will bring you into the conversation, say like what works for you, because if it doesn't work for you, then it's a system that is not worth it. So like it. While it is, you have to kind of play by the studio's rules or people who hired you, their rules. Mm-hmm. It's not without its merit to at least say, hey, this isn't working for me. Can we find a workaround? Otherwise, like, it's not going to work at all for anybody.
Have you ever been thrown a curveball on a particular tool or rule or ask for a client system or a team system?
I think the biggest one I've ever had, this seems so petty, but it really was, I had to basically chart out how I was designing things and almost like a spider web chart of, you know, this went to here and then we decided these things. And I spent 2 hours someone wanted a visual of how we got to a decision. And that was 3 hours of my life wasted trying to showcase how we got to a decision in a visual way versus 3 images. Yeah, versus 3 images, like circle this option, this option, this option. Here's the final.
Right, right.
Wow.
So they were asking you to do a different job, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah. And so I wouldn't say, like, if beyond that, I've actually been okay, but then again, I haven't had to deal with too many other versions. Like, I think, like, you know, Adobe Cloud, Jira, different kinds of charting systems. I've never had to do anything nearly as intensive as like designers do with different systems with plotting out. I think the biggest thing is like Slack and Discord are the ones that are a bit of a sticking point because you lose information. But honestly, no, I haven't. I've been very lucky in that sense. So.
Yeah. So I guess maybe you don't have maybe your experiences are too good to have a strong opinion on this, but how much appetite do you have for designing those systems versus just like learning whatever it is you're walking into and adapting to it?
Let's see. I would probably say I have way less of an appetite for designing them, but It's because until there is a point in the system that it becomes a problem for me, where this is taking too much time, this isn't working, we need to find a workaround to make me actually be able to finish and get things on time. I find that it's almost easier to go with the flow and test it out, because if you're too stuck in your way of, no, I need to do it by this way, it's sort of setting yourself up for failure, mm-hmm. because you need to at least test it out and then make your decision.
Yeah.
The biggest one I would say is more like the naming conventions, because if you're so used to naming conventions, switching your brain is going to take more time, yeah, and it's going to make you have to think and be more careful. It's annoying, if anything else, but it's also the fact that these systems, they ripple out to everybody mm-hmm. in the art team.
Yeah.
So once again, lower on the totem pole when it comes to the art team, how much sway do I really want to give? And is this going to help, you know, the 3D artists, or is it going to hinder them? Because this is how it works for them.
Sure. So, yeah. I think it's important to state that, like, and I don't think you're saying the opposite of this, but I think it's important to state that, like, concept artists also need help with the system in order for them to be able to get things done as well. Mm-hmm. And so, like, yeah. if there's like a naming convention that works for the 3D artists or the texture or whoever, and it makes it more difficult for you to get your work done, that should be considered a problem and it should be resolved in some way.
Yeah.
And maybe somebody has to make compromises because, like, there's no perfect solutions for everything. But just because you're, like, earlier on in the working process doesn't mean that you shouldn't also have priority in how things work, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you have your project managers, your producers to help you find those balances.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Thank you for seeing us. Thank you for...
I mean, we invited you on the show for a reason.
Yeah. True. Yep.
So, Stephen, we don't ask people this a lot.
Yeah.
But I think what I'd like to ask listeners, and that's you listening now, just in case you thought this was just a private conversation.
Yeah, not me.
is we'd like you to help us spread the word about the show.
Yeah.
The only way we get new listeners is if listeners tell other people to become listeners. It's very simple math.
Yep.
I've double-checked it. but that requires you. What would be ways that people could do that other than awkwardly at a dinner party? Which is an option.
You could also do it non-awkwardly at a dinner party.
I mean, I don't know if that's possible, but your mileage may vary on that.
You can send them a link on Discord. You can post about it on social media. You can literally just call up a friend and be like, hey, how's it going? Listen to this podcast. I love it. Uh-huh.
you could do what I did, which was go to Micro Center. And when you're trying out all the different laptops, test out the keyboards by going to nicegames.club and leaving the browser window open.
Oh, that's great.
You could stealth. Yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, we're looking for people to be on our street team is what we're at.
Yes.
You should, like the Muppets, go underneath the tables at a fancy restaurant and start whispering about nicegames.club.
Well, I mean, maybe you don't have to be that invested, but if you like the show,
yeah.
if there's an episode of the show that taught you something, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. maybe share that episode. You don't have to tell people, like, hey, here's this thing I'm promoting. You can say, hey, this is a piece of information that was useful to me.
Yeah.
If that's something that strikes your fancy, we would really appreciate it. Any way you can, right?
Yes, yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Well, I think I could talk forever about communication protocols and stuff like that, like how teams are built and structured.
Yeah.
But I think once you sort of have that going or figure that out, there's sort of two other areas I think would be interesting to get into.
Yeah.
One is like how you design your actual project files for this iterative process. But also, like the actual steps along the process, like, you know, when you, onboarding yourself onto a team, what are the first things you do? And so those are two different areas.
Yeah, I feel I've got a lot more to say about the second question. So let's go to the first question.
Okay.
I think.
Okay. So I think for folks who, you know, do art, especially 2D art and like know Photoshop, you know, we know how Photoshop works because there's layers and pixels, it's, you know. But I think what are the, what maybe the tips or the, sort of structures that, that have helped you when designing concept art to allow yourself to be iterative, to work quickly, that maybe, someone who is just, designing for, either they're a fine artist or they're an asset, artist that they may not understand or know.
This is probably advice that a lot of artists are hearing whenever they start off, whenever they're doing, you know, they're switching from like say 2D and traditional work to digital, is don't fight against your workflow. There are tons of like hundreds upon hundreds of ways to do something. You know, you're gonna find tutorials for painting, for photo bashing, for integrating 3D pieces into your work. You know, doing Blender. Pieces and then bring them into Photoshop or anything like that. Whatever the system that you find works, work with it. If something is working and you're producing great work, find ways to integrate other pieces to it. Don't immediately think, oh, well, this is no longer correct. I have to do it by the book because there is no book is my first advice. But it's a little bit more of trying things out and very much finding what is your sticking point in terms of where are you wasting your most time. And I say wasting as in you spend a ton of time designing the pose for a character, or like you just need to have something very simple, but you're doing a lot of them and it's taking a lot of time to iterate. It's like taking a lot of time to copy and paste. Find a way to try and cut down that time is the best way of doing it. So for example, I have had to do character concepts a lot. And they're usually background characters. They're no one who is a very important. They don't have a lot of personality, but you do need to see what the style is, what the actual world state is. And part of that is through the characters. So what I would actually do is I would just have base documents of, here's a pose I've drawn. Here's a sketch or a render of a character that is a blank slate. Here's different sizes. And I'm just going to use that as the base because it takes way too long to do something from scratch, then bring it in. It's already work I've done, but it's easier to just bring it in from a starting point or like I'm going to say a checkpoint because we're all in games.
Yeah.
and then kind of work off of it, or you're taking so long on texturing that it's taking forever. Like you don't need it. You have to sort of find that shortcut of, all right, do I need to paint this texture one-to-one? Not really. Do I have the rights to this photo that has a very similar texture? Yes. Let's use that, paint over it. Because concept art is so quick, iterative, you need to be able to produce. It doesn't need to be perfect. Finding these rough cuts, these shortcuts, making it look presentable, making it look complete and clean enough that you get your ideas is the biggest time saver.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that you get over time? Because I imagine it's sometimes hard to get a sense of what is enough to convey the thing. Because it sounds a little bit like fashion illustration in terms of you need to get it super, super quick, but it has to communicate everything. And that's it's hard to get a certain amount of fidelity without fidelitying yourself into the next day.
Yes. I think you're right. It's a lot like fashion sketching and like the actual design, because it is something you learn over time of how much is too much and how much is too little. And that is something you get from practice, from working on your own personal projects, from working with game jams, from studios, anything really. It's not going to be something that you learn overnight, but it is a process that is important for everyone to kind of learn when they're getting into art. And it'll come naturally. It really is all I can say is that there are so many artists I know who are so terrified that, you know, they're not where they want to be just yet. They haven't learned the system or they haven't figured out how to do this quickly. There's so much I haven't learned either, but it is a process that just keeps coming.
Yeah.
And like speed and fidelity comes with time. It really is just the more you make, the more you learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So what about outside of, say, a Wacom tablet or Cintiq or something like that with a pen, like that I think people would be like, oh, that's what I would probably need to use for things like this. What are the tools that you would either recommend to folks to either to use because you use them or to try to see if it would work for them outside of the sort of expected? Like, I need something to put in my hand and probably Photoshop, maybe Procreate to actually create with.
Yeah. So definitely, I mean, that's always the thing. It's like Procreate, Photoshop, Clip Studio Paint. Those are the ones that everyone knows. You're right. There's also things like the 3D modeling side. Concept artists nowadays are using a lot of 3D, sort of block things out. Mm. That's also really well known. What I would say is don't overlook physical media. Mm-hmm. Don't overlook, you know, sketching in your sketchbook, trying things out with markers, trying things out with paints. Anything that is, you know, digital is really amazing, but it can also be very limiting. Something that I actually do is, and I learned it from the guys on Dishonored, mm-hmm. is sculpting. Actually taking clay, pulling things out. One of the, actually for Anomaly, the last game that I was working on with Green Sky, I actually had plasticine and like I was making these cardboard sort of cutouts and all these sculptures just to try and see how things would move and how things would work in a physical space.
Yeah.
And because it is like it was a VR game. So you're in a physical space. How are you able to interact with it? How do you think it's going to move? Truly, I don't think there's any medium that is not worth looking into. Mm. If you think you can get some kind of value out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen concert artists who love doing sculpture with glass or even some kinds of really incredible welding. And that becomes part of something that they take in and then they use it either as reference or they build it and they see how it works.
Yeah.
But
is there any, that just makes me think of like medium is the message. Like, is there any kind of like, would you find yourself on a project using a particular type of almost prototyping essentially materials or tool sets that inform the style? And how much of that is your domain as a concept artist versus an art director or a creative director?
I think it's more than you think. It's a little bit more of the concept artist. Like, obviously, the art director, the creative director, they are the ones who are going to set the briefs. They're the ones who set a lot of things. But concept art has a oddly broad amount of control and freedom when it comes to some of these things, especially if you're higher up as a concert artist, if you've been doing it a long time, you get a lot more freedom to say, all right, well, I know that this is the references and this is the brief and this is like the concert art that my art lead has already given me. I'm going to take this and run. And that's how we get the, you know, pieces that could be used or could be seen as like, all right, well, this is really cool. We might use it or we don't want this at all. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, I think it is a lot more of like the freedom beyond just we have that control to try and move things and shape them because it's just a weird sort of like echoing factor of I made this concept. It now introduces it to the designers and like the art lead really likes it. So the art lead brings it to the lead designers and that just kind of snowballs into all of a sudden we've got a game about, you know, let's just say like Crazy Rabbits, because my brain went to Raving Rabbits for some reason. But it is sort of one piece of art can actually change a whole lot in a project, even without meaning to.
Right, right. It's the responsibility and burden of first execution. Mm. Right.
Yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's fantastic.
It's also it's the burden of I made this as a joke. Wait, why is it in a game now?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
So concept art oftentimes is shared as part of like bonuses, or I'm thinking like I own books of concept art of some of my favorite games. Yeah. Is there a part of your workflow towards the end of the game's life where, you know, you have to package or choose or pick some of or deliver that sort of thing? Or is there ever a editor-esque kind of person in the back of your head going, the people might see this outside your team?
Are you ever designing for the coffee table book?
A little bit, yeah. Or have you ever had to just shut that off because it's going to get in the way of you making the concept art for the team first and foremost?
I mean, I always love to go back and you know, this might be for the coffee shop, like bake, or for the coffee table book. This has to be very good. This has to be perfect. Because sometimes you are tasked with making like a really nice illustration work mm-hmm. to show to investors or to show the team to get them hyped. Mm. So even as I said, you know, most of my work isn't the beautiful pieces. Sometimes it is. Sometimes I do have to do that. But a lot of time at the end of a cycle, either you're being put on a new project or you are asked to do a lot of the illustrative work that goes into press releases or pieces that are going to go on the Steam page, things that are a lot more of the like front facing. Mm-hmm. But it is a little bit of, you know, shut off the back of the head. But in my personal time, I have gone back and finished things up and made them really pretty, because beyond just being, you know, front facing, it is a piece of work that goes into an artist portfolio, and you want your best pieces. So you want to have good pieces no matter what you do, but not always possible. So you take the ones that you love and the ones that you did really well on and that you had the time and the energy to create. And then you're able to say, like, all right, now I have a bit of extra time to finish this up and make it pretty.
Yeah. And it sounds like you're supplying your sort of smart reasons for doing that, but also probably you kind of just want to do that. You're an artist.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because at some point you sort of look and, you know, it is the artist idea of like, oh, nothing I did was good on this project, but it answered all the questions and it got done is better than perfect is always the adage.
Yeah.
But sometimes you want it to be perfect. So you have to go back and finish it.
Well, and I think that's kind of nice that like you can go back to certain art, some things, like you killed some darlings, but like you can bring them back to life and put them in your portfolio if you want to.
And it's also very much in a state where it is at a perfect checkpoint to then be made better.
Yeah.
Because it's not a finished piece. It's not a front-facing fine art piece. It is meant to be like the starting point.
Yeah. And then it's yours and you can do with it as you please.
Yeah.
Just neat.
Yeah. And I mean, that's definitely much more of a you know, contractor side. Studio times, sometimes you are just given like, all right, this was really good. Can you refine it? We need to use this or something.
So in a studio environment, do you find yourself doing a lot of that that key art? Is it just because you have the same skill set required for that kind of illustrative work, or is that a standard? Is that a pretty common role for a concept artist to also work with those types of assets?
Let's see. It is more standard the higher up you go, because the more experienced artists are going to be able to produce, you know, these beautiful pieces. Even for them, it could be considered a little bit rougher. I mean, Matt Rhodes, who does a ton of stuff for BioWare. You know, he did a whole bunch of stuff for Dragon Age, all the way to the beginning, Mass Effect. He was the one who designed the shot of the elusive man with the sun behind him. Mm-hmm. But all of his work, you know, it's rough from his standard, but, you know, as you see it, it's this beautiful composition. It's gorgeous. But for him, it's something he has to do pumping out. And so the higher you get, the more sort of time you are able to do this and be able to be given the task of just make a beauty shot.
Yeah.
The lower you go, and like, you know, as a someone who's starting off and someone who's in like the worker bee sort of situation as a concept artist, oftentimes you've got too many tasks to make like really delicate and beautiful pieces of art. You just need to deliver on time. If you are like, you know, sometimes a concept artist who is just starting off is given like the beauty shots because they have the skill. And many concept artists are very well done or are very well versed in these beautiful illustration pieces because it is something and it's a skill to do. And so it is a bit of a gambit. In studio, it definitely is a lot of depending on where in your journey you are and what the needs of the game are. But for myself, I found that it was less the illustrative pieces, the longer into development it was. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of development, you have a lot more time of finding out what the game is going to be like and a lot more, I guess, time and less expectations. Like, the design document hasn't been filled out completely. Everyone's in sort of the starry-eyed stage of what this could be.
Yeah.
So I can make whatever. Mm-hmm. But as things go on, I now have, you know, 17 enemies to design with a full turnarounds. I have to do these characters. Do I have the time to go into an illustration piece? Not unless it's the top of the list. Mm-hmm. So.
Right, right. Well, that gets into sort of the final area that I wanted to get your thoughts on, is this sort of like every step along the way, right? So those key art pieces would happen at the end, and you described a lot about what happens at the very beginning, and then also what happens when you're very busy, which is cranking out lots of things.
Yeah.
Can you sort of just plot out the arc of a project, like in terms of the demands of a concept artist? Because I think a lot of people think, oh, concept art, it's someone who they work for 6 months, they produce all of these things, and then they go away. And, like, I think, obviously, by now, anyone listening to this episode knows that's definitely not how it works. But is there a point in the project where it does start to slow down? And what part of the project does it start to pick up? Like, is it really early? Is it mid-development? Is it when everyone else is crunching?
I would hate to say that is it when everyone else is crunching, but it might be. So, you know, the concept artist should be brought on rather early. Right. You know, it's in the pre-production stage. You know, there's a design idea. There is a, well, let's be honest, a concept of a game coming out. Like, someone wants to do a shooter. We now know it. We now have it as, you know, we've pitched it as a sci-fi thing. We need to now design what all that looks like. So pre-production, when they're sort of designing the game itself, all the modules, all of the systems, that is sort of the beginning ramping up into, depending on what your specialty is in concept art, you could be doing environments or characters, or you could be doing things like starting to refine into, this is kind of what we're thinking. In the ideal world, as development goes on, pre-production goes into production, which is where you start to ramp up a little bit more into the things like prop design, character designs, things that need a lot more one-to-one for the 3D team. So instead of just, here's the vague ideas and this is what we're basing it on, now we're into, we need to know exactly what this character looks like and then get it into the game. This obviously is not a perfect world. We have setbacks. We have changes. Sometimes a game gets completely rearranged. So you got to go back to pre-production in the middle of production to create new concept work. Mm-hmm. It happens. It's not fun, but I mean, it is a reality. By the end, hopefully, you know, if all things go well, you start to wrap up. There's no more last minute things. It's sort of everything at least has been integrated to a point that it makes sense. The team has an idea of what things look like. No more answers need to be given, hopefully. You then kind of wrap up on concept art, maybe doing illustration work, maybe doing some press work, you know, the pieces for the Steam page, everything like mm-hmm. that also could be hired out to a company that does it specifically. Mm-hmm. So you might not be working on it. And then if it is a studio, oftentimes by that point, there is another project that is going into pre-production or is starting to be talked about. So you might be pulled onto that. There might be another project that needs a artist to be put onto it. So you, by the end, hopefully when everyone's crunching to get it done, you are not needed. Mm-hmm. And then you can move on, because if you need the concept artist at the end, that means you have a lot of new things to be put into at the
end.
Yeah,
actually, right. Yeah.
That's a sign of something else. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. It's not the end of the world. Maybe it's just something really small,
yeah,
but it's not the best sign.
Yeah.
Right, right, right. Sometimes it could be like, you know, let's bring in the concept artist to help us answer this question because we can get it answered a lot quicker that way.
Sure.
And other times it's like, oh no, we forgot to answer this question earlier. Yeah.
What does the final boss look like? Oh, yeah, I hope that's not the case.
Yeah.
There has been one time where I had to do like, oh, we didn't design what the level for the final boss is.
Like, oh.
Okay, let's do this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess that really shows why it's helpful to have someone on hand for that kind of work, right?
Yeah.
When you have those questions, yes. Like it's you can get it's just like any type of prototyping, right? Like if you and it's just a different skill set that I think a lot of teams will find themselves either making changes near the end of a project or not realizing that there's work that they should have done that they weren't tracking and now they're falling behind on.
Yeah.
Having a concept artist to be able to help you prototype those visual concepts even well into production is probably something that I suspect a lot of teams don't realize the benefit of until they really need it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That's exactly it. It's you don't know you need it until you need it is yeah. really the phrase.
Yeah. Okay. A lot to digest.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, Laura, would you say there's more to say, but it would take another episode?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I could go on for like three more if you want me back.
Well, we'll get that on the calendar. But in the meantime, listeners can go back to the first one we had with Laura or listen to this one again and really let it sink in.
Yeah.
But thank you for coming back. It was a delight.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me back.
That's our show. You can find Laura online at Blue Sky and ArtStation. Links in the show notes. For show notes and additional links from today's conversation, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode, or others, or whatever, with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be looking at Micro Studio and min-maxing. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
Well, okay, real quick, is there anything, Laura, that we didn't get to that you want to talk about in the episode?
Nothing that wouldn't take another episode, okay. But yeah.
Okay.
No, I mean, I hope I answered the questions is my biggest thing.
No, you definitely did. I just wanted to confirm. Okay.
All right, we'll cut all this bit out.
Yeah.